Hello and welcome along to the Arts Hour on the BBC World Service with me, Nikki Beatty. 60 minutes of the very best film, music, television, art and literature from the BBC, chosen by me just for you and your listening pleasure. On today's show, India's beat poets from the 1960s scene in Calcutta and how they inspired American beat writer Allen Ginsberg with their literary rule-breaking and social taboo-smashing. British Asian film director Gurinder Chadha tells us why she's so excited to transfer her super successful film Bend It Like Beckham to the stage as a musical. The Grammy award-winning duo Macklemore and Ryan Lewis on why they're stretching the boundaries of hip-hop.
I'm not trying to worry about what people think about me. I don't care about how they judge me or the box that they put me in or anything like that. What's important is connecting with human beings from the heart.
That's Ben Haggerty, a.k.a. Macklemore. We also have real-life drama today, a heist, in fact. The object stolen? A violin. Not just any violin, the Lipinski Stradivarius. Value? More than $5 million. And Hollywood actor Michael Keaton distances himself from the character he's playing in the outstanding new movie, Birdman.
You know, I really admire what Regan Thompson did. Took a lot of courage. And he's also extremely pathetic and, to me, disgustingly needy. And I don't get that. I'm not built like that.
I put my money on the Best Actor Oscar going to him. But then again, this guy's in with a chance too. With Golden Globe, Screen Actors Guild and Critics' Choice nominations for Best Actor already, Eddie Redmayne will surely get an Oscar nod in the same category for his latest role in The Theory of Everything. The film is described as a biopic of physicist Stephen Hawking's life, but more accurately, I'd say it's an account of the professor's marriage to Jane Wilde, a fellow student he met at Cambridge University in England, and it's based on her memoir.
If Einstein is right, or if general relativity is correct, then yes. Universe is expanding, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so if you reverse time, then the universe is getting smaller.
All right.
So, what if I reverse the process all the way back to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
At the beginning of time itself?
Yes. So the universe getting smaller and smaller, getting denser and denser, hotter and hotter
as we... You mean wind back the clock?
Exactly, wind back the clock.
Wind back the clock.
Felicity Jones and Eddie Redmayne in a clip from The Theory of Everything. Professor Stephen Hawking is a hugely successful scientist. He suffers from a rare, slowly progressing form of Lou Gehrig's disease, which has gradually paralyzed him over the decades. He uses a specially modified wheelchair and communicates by using a single cheek muscle attached to a speech-generating device, and that produces a unique sound. Well, apparently, Hawking was impressed by actor Eddie Redmayne's portrayal of him. But speaking to fellow actor Sanjeev Bhaskar on the BBC recently, Eddie revealed he'd actually only met Hawking a few days before filming began.
I met him about 5 days before he started filming, and by that point I'd spent 4 months sort of researching him and researching everything about him. And he's an incredibly busy man, solving some quite intense problems out there in the universe. His schedule was quite insane. So I could only meet him those few days before. And what was complicated is because we weren't shooting the film chronologically, I was playing him from different periods in his life over the same day of filming, is I'd had to sort of plan out in some ways what the arc of the character would be. And the fear when I met him was, what if I've got it completely wrong? I've only got sort of 2 days or 3 days to sort it out. And so when I met him, I was nervous enough as it was. And when you speak to him now, there's a very sort of unique rhythm. There are long, long pauses. It takes him a while to speak. And I have a sort of weird the hatred of silence. And so I basically just proceeded to spew forth information about Stephen Hawking to Stephen Hawking for about 45 minutes. It was verging on the horrific. He was sort of looking at me going, yes, I do know about myself. But I calmed down and he was just brilliant. He was witty, had this razor wit and a sense of mischief, a kind of anarchic quality that was wonderful.
Did he ask you any questions at that point about how you were going to portray him? Or
I mean, he did. He asked me if I was playing him before the voice machine. And I said yes. And he then said my voice was very slurred. And it was interesting because at that time, there is one documentary of Stephen when he was speaking, and his voice is almost incomprehensible.
That's when someone's translating for
exactly,
him.
Exactly that. And I had wanted to go that far because all the work I was doing before, all the stuff I was portraying him before, that was a sort of educated guess. But suddenly I had something to actually, that I knew was true. And the producers were a little worried about having subtitles in the film, so they didn't want me to go that far. So I said this to Steve, and he said, well, could you not have someone translate me? Which was what happened. So Jane, his wife, would translate him, or his students. If you wanted to be one of Steven's students, you went and spent a couple of weeks learning to lip read and understand him. And so when Stephen said that to me, I kind of could take that back to James, the director, and Anthony. And Anthony wove in some scenes, Anthony, the writer, in which Jane does translate Stephen so that we could get at least closer to, because that was the one thing he really cared about.
Didn't he say that he, after seeing the film, that at times he thought it was himself out there?
I heard that, which frankly was the greatest review of my life, and I might never work again. I might just retire. But it was, no, the stakes for Felicity, and I felt so high from the second we were cast that actually we hadn't even realised it, but we've been walking around with sort of hunched up shoulders for sort of 9 months. And just before, I saw Stephen just before he went to see the film, and I said, you know, Stephen, I'm really nervous, but, you know, let me know what you think. And he took a while to respond, and then he said, in his iconic voice, he said, I will let you know what I think, good or otherwise.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, Stephen, if it's otherwise, maybe you could just stick to otherwise. We don't need the intricacies of everything I got wrong. But no, so when he was nice about the film, it meant the world.
But he also visited set as well, as did Jane.
Yeah.
Is that right? I mean, I can't think of anything more terrifying.
Well, I could tell you, Stephen's entrance was unlike anything I've ever seen. Jane, Jonathan, the family are so wonderful, but they all came this one evening, and we were doing a May ball scene, and there was this huge fireworks display, and the producers had bought three sets of fireworks because fireworks are pretty pricey, so we only had three takes of it, and that meant that everyone was a wee bit nervous about that, and then on cue, Stephen arrived, flanked by his nurses, spotlit by his computer screen, and literally on cue, the fireworks went off. And I describe it as the great rock star entrance. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. But that night, Jane and Jonathan were on one side of our eye line, and Stephen and his carers were on the other side. And Felicity and I just, Felicity Jones, who plays Jane, we just clung together, sort of trying to hope we weren't being judged too much.
I mean, you talked earlier about the arc, and particularly shooting out of sequence. Did you have a system for kind of then knowing where you would be?
Yeah, I did is because there's no documentary footage of Stephen before he's in the wheelchair that I could find, I basically took as many photographs as I could to the Queen Square Neurology Clinic, and there is a specialist there called Dr. Katie Seidel, and she would look at the photos and by analysing the photos would tell me what she thought Stephen's specific progression could have been. So I then basically charted through on a piece of paper which muscles went when, as it were.
Wow.
And then I worked with a dancer, a choreographer called Alex Reynolds, and Alex basically helped me train the muscles to be able to sustain these positions for extended takes. But also, I tried to learn the different stages of physicality like a dance, because, you know, when you learn a dance, to begin with, I'm a shoddy dancer, and when I start... all you're thinking about is what your feet are doing. But once you really know it, you can then be expressive within the confines of the dance. And I tried to learn the physicalities like that so that when it came to playing with Felicity, we could just play the human story. Because the most important thing for me is that when you meet Stephen, the illness couldn't be less interesting to him. He's someone that lives passionately and fully.
In terms of getting into character, did you have a mantra? Did you listen to music? Did you have pictures that you looked
at? I had a couple of pictures, yeah. Oh, right. I had three pictures in my trailer, which one was that famous photo of Einstein with his tongue out.
Oh, yeah.
And the second was James Dean.
Oh.
Weirdly, because when you look at Stephen when he's younger, he has this kind of disheveled confidence and kind of this cool, which is effortless, and he's a ladies' man as well. There was that sort of... and then the last was a picture of a joker in a pack of cards with a puppet, with a marionette, because that, again, that Lord of Misrule idea, this the anarchic thing, but also the power. Like when he's in a room, he absolutely controls the room, and you really feel that with him. And so that kind of capricious quality was important.
That's a fantastic summing up. Three pictures that sum up Stephen Hawking. That's extraordinary.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I'd like to tell Stephen that. These are the three photos that sum you up.
Actor Eddie Redmayne talking about his role as Professor Stephen Hawking in new movie The Theory of Everything. And hark! What's that I hear? Ah, the clatter of awards falling off his trophy cabinet shelf. You're listening to The Arts Hour on the BBC World Service, and it's to India we head now, to Kolkata, the city formerly known as Calcutta, the capital of West Bengal, a state famed for its highly cultured people like Nobel Literary Laureate Rabindranath Tagore, visionary filmmaker Satyajit Ray, the list is long. The Hungry Generation was a movement of angry young poets in 1960s Calcutta whose anti-establishment antics struck a chord with the American beat writer Allen Ginsberg. For all you millennials, here's a quick beat poet's explanation. So the Beat Generation were a group of American writers who emerged post-World War II and include names alongside Ginsberg like William S. Burroughs and Jack Kerouac. They rejected societal standards, innovated when it came to style, literary and otherwise. They used illegal drugs, loved alternative sexuality. They were interested in religion, rejected materialism, and loved to explore the wretchedness and wonder of the human condition. So, when Allen Ginsberg made a trip to India in 1962, he met the Hungry Generation, or Hungrialists, as they're also known, and saw in them a younger version of himself, confused, without money, trying to find their voice as writers. Let's hear first of all from Firoz Basu, the son of one of those poets, and the American writer you'll hear thereafter is Deborah Baker, author of A Blue Hand, The Beats in India.
I'm Firoz Basu. My father, Utpal Kumar Basu, is a famous poet. He is a Bengali poet who was a part of the Hungrialist movement in the 1960s in Bengal. And we are at the banks of the Hooghly River, and this is a place called Nimtola Ghat, which is doubles up as a crematorium. There are two wooden funeral pyres which are burning in front of me, and the air is full of smoke, and of course there's a hum of the mourning relatives, and there's also priests who are reciting the funeral chants, and it's a very, very somber atmosphere here. And this is where Allen Ginsberg came with the Hungrialist poets of Bengal in the 1960s to perform poetry.
But he also, in these early weeks in Calcutta, Allen Ginsberg met a young holy man, and it was this guy who introduced him to the burning ghats of Nimtala. And in the night, they would go with the poets that he met to the burning ghat, which is in North Calcutta, where people bring their dearly departed ones to be cremated and have their ashes let go in the Hooghly River. And he would just sit there and watch these bodies fall apart and attempt to get over his fear of death and of dying.
I am Shomir Rai Choudhury. I am co-founder of Hungry Generation. I'm 18 years old and still going strong. And I will live for 1,000 years, I hope. Adda. Adda means getting together at a place, mixing freely with people around it. And some people used to recite poems. Those who can sing, they will sing. Those who will recite poems, they will recite poems. Like that. Places we choose, they are those places which are linked up with the rejected one. Say, Nimtala Burning Ghat. Nimtala Burning Ghat we used to do. What is, after all, a graveyard? A graveyard is people who have been rejected by the universe. We are just singing our song, reciting our poems, and all that.
I may go, but why? by Shakti Chattopadhyay. Thinking, it's better to turn back. So much dirt on my hands over so many years. Never thought of you as you. Now, next to the ravine in the night, the moon beckons. Come. I stand on the Ganga's banks, sleepy. The wooden pyre beckons. Come. Come.
I'm Malai Roy Chowdhury. I co-founded the Hungry Generation Movement along with my brother Samir Roy Chowdhury. Everybody came from slum. At that time they were called untouchables, untouchable Hindus. We are residing in that area. So a lot of people were scared of coming to our areas. So we represented a particular milieu. So we were groomed in a different way altogether.
I may go any way I wish, but why? Will hold my child to kiss her face. I will go, but not now. I'll take all of you with me. Won't go all of a sudden, alone.
That was from India's Beats, The Hungry Generation. And if you'd like to hear the whole programme, just head to our website for details, bbcworldservice.com/artshour. And the show is also this week's BBC World Service Tuesday documentary. Hip hop now on the Arts Hour. And what are your associations with that culture? MCing and rapping? DJing and scratching? Breakdancing and graffiti writing? Well, they're all part of it. But sadly, a lot of that world has become synonymous with gangster lyrics, misogyny, and homophobia. Grammy Award-winning hip-hop duo Macklemore and Ryan Lewis are a bit different. Have a listen.
He doesn't sleep, so in truth he never wakes up. Another day rushed into his death at a breath on the treadmill of the famous.
That's a track called Arrows. It's by American indie band Fences, featuring our hip-hop duo Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. They're unique in the business, totally independent, not signed to any label, and they make great hip-hop, conscious hip-hop. Last year, they were nominated for 7 Grammy Awards and won 4. Best New Artist, Best Rap Album for The Heist, Best Rap Song, and Best Rap Performance. The BBC's DJ Semtex went to Seattle to meet them. And what you'll hear first is their track, Same Love. The title itself explains the content.
Same Love's interesting. It really created conversation. It really was a nudge to show that how far hip-hop had come. It had grown up a lot, because before then, hip-hop had always been seen as, you know, incredibly misogynistic and homophobic. This track said something in a very eloquent way that hadn't been done before. This was taking hip-hop to new ground, to new territory.
When I was in the 3rd grade, I thought that I was gay, cause I could draw, my uncle was, and I kept my room straight. I told my mom, tears rushing down my face, she's like, Ben, you've loved girls since before pre-K. Tripping. Yeah, I guess she had a point, didn't she? Bunch of stereotypes all in my head. I remember doing the math, like, yeah, I'm good at Little League. A preconceived idea of what it all meant for those that like the same sex, had the characteristics. The right-wing conservatives think it's a decision, and you can be cured with some treatment and religion. Man-made rewiring of a predisposition, playing God. Oh nah, here we go. America the brave still fears what we don't know. God loves all his children. It's somehow forgotten, but we paraphrase a book written 3,500 years ago.
Bye-bye,
I don't know.
Bye-bye. And I can't change. Bye-bye. Even if I tried, even if I wanted to.
Was gay, I would think hip-hop hates me. Have you read the YouTube comments lately?
What you did with Same Love never been done before. It's saying things on a track which hadn't been said, and you got people talking. Like, you really did get the hip-hop nation kind of
openly discussing something which kind of never really got talked about.
Yeah.
When you were making that track, did you ever feel like this, you know, as an MC, that this might be a bad move?
Absolutely. I mean, the first two bars are when I was in third grade, I thought that I was gay. The first bar.
You know, some people think you're gay because you said that.
There's like 25% of the population, maybe 50% of the population thinks I'm gay because of that bar.
Right.
Who cares? I know my truth.
Same Love is so not hip-hop and so 100% hip-hop at the same time. On the one hand, a subject matter and a perspective that could be as not hip-hop as you can imagine, but the balls to address something not being addressed in society, humanity, and the way that we're treating people, XYZ, to me, that's a foundation of hip-hop.
You put that on a scale, can I be vulnerable? Can I be myself? Can I tell my story? Like, that was the truth. How can I not say that? That's who I am. To put it on the scale, because of course we had thoughts. I'm like, you know, at the time I had like Schoolboy Q on the record, Absol. I'm like, what are they gonna think? You know, are they gonna wanna be on the album? You know, I'm like in my head in that way. But it's like on the scale of things, like that's my experience, that's my story. I can't censor that. And of course you wanna get love from everybody, but you put it on the scale and I'm like, I'm trying to be free, man. I'm not trying to worry about what people think about me. I don't care about how they judge me or the box that they put me in or anything like that. What's important is connecting with human beings from the heart, and that's what Same Love was.
No law is gonna change us. We have to change us. Whatever God you believe in, we come from the same one. Strip away the fear. Underneath, it's all the same love. About time that we raised up.
I can't
DJ Semtex talking to Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. And that program information, in case you want to hear the whole show, is on our website. Don't go away, there's lots more to come. And the Arts Hour's back after this. She keeps me on.